Well, let's get going here. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Jabara. I head up exchange-traded fund and closed-end fund research at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Today's panel is on MLPs and what's going on in the market. And I know one of the things that intrigued me about this panel is, I speak with financial advisors and their clients all day long, and this MLPs is still one of the questions around MLPs and what's going on is still one of the most popular questions that I do get. So hopefully this panel is worthwhile. We're going to leave probably 7 or 8 minutes at the end for all of you to ask questions. But before we get started, I just want every panelist to introduce themselves and give maybe like a 30 to 40 second rundown as far as what they and their firm do.
Okay, thanks, Mike. My name is Ed Russell, Senior Managing Director with Tortoise Capital Advisors. We manage about $17 billion in the energy space. We do it through closed-end funds, open-end funds, separately managed accounts, and we have a couple ETFs as well.
My name is Jay Hatfield, and I'm the founder and CEO of InfraCap. We have two ETFs, both of which I'm the portfolio manager of. One we just launched is PFFR, which is the InfraCap REIT preferred ETF, and we also have the only actively managed MLP ETF, which is AMZA, which is the InfraCap MLP fund. Our firm is also a co-founder of NGL Energy Partners, which is a New York Stock Exchange traded MLP.
Hi, my name is Ben Okin. I'm a vice president at Goldman Sachs Asset Management on the energy and infrastructure team. Our team manages several different strategies, roughly $10.5 billion. And just real quick, the views and opinions that I express today are my own and for informational purposes only and do not constitute a recommendation by GSAM. Just get that out of the way real quick.
I like that disclosure.
Way to go.
Yeah, we all should have done one of those.
We'll let them cover that for all of us.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, I prepared a bunch of questions, and I'm going to start with Jay. And one of the questions that I've been getting, post-election is with the new administration, what does that do to the pipeline business? Does it dramatically change it? Are there more opportunities? What are some of the negative ramifications, if any? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that front.
Well, I think it's sort of obvious that unlike the regular energy sector, just drilling, which is not as directly impacted, but just to have an administration that's not actively opposed to the completion or initiation of build of pipeline construction, I think is a huge positive and was reflected early on when Trump was elected. And unlike a lot of other theses that haven't really played out, like sort of general theoretical infrastructure building, almost immediately, the Trump administration allowed the Dakota Access Pipeline to go forward and is allowing other pipelines to move forward as well. So I think that really got the sector going and people interested in that. And it's more tangible outcome relative to some of the other opportunities that require legislation.
Do you see any negative ramifications? I mean, one thing that I've heard is that now the environmentalists are going to protest everything, right? And no matter what it is, it's just going to be anti-pipelines, anti-energy. Do you see anything on the negative front as far as the new administration?
Well, I mean, I think I don't really fear the protesting so much. I think that's probably healthy for everybody involved. But to the extent it gets backed up by the Army Corps of Engineers, that's when it starts to be a problem. So it's great if people want to protest. I would wish they'd protest coal-fired power plants and things that really harm the environment versus natural gas pipelines, but perhaps they'll figure that out over time. But I don't think it was the protesting per se. It was just having the Army Corps back it up.
Sure, sure. Okay, no, that's...
I do think it's important to add, though, that although from at the federal government level, we certainly have seen some improvement in the attitude and outlook, but the local area is still having the same challenges for pipelines, which are primarily driven by, not in my backyard kind of things, not necessarily objecting to the pipeline itself. They just want it someplace else. So it's important to not just assume that the regulatory environment throughout the country in each situation is now improved. It's really specifically at the federal level.
Federal level.
And I think the other thing that's also interesting to think about is the extent it's more difficult to build pipelines. That's not great for the growth story. But the extent that all the companies we invest in have massive amounts of built pipelines, it really makes them a little bit more valuable.
Yep.
And that's really what I think most of us on this panel probably focus on is the companies with franchise value that have assets that are hard to build, that do have rights of way, that do have real estate, that are in sensitive areas like New York Harbor where you can have storage, and that are almost like having an office building in Manhattan where it's hard to get it permitted, hard to get the rights to build. So, like I said, it's just a bit of a double-edged sword.
I would also add that I think just, you know, if you go on whitehouse.gov and you look at the issues, the first issue on there is energy independence for the U.S. So I think it's, you know, and you look at who the Secretary of State is, the old CEO of ExxonMobil. Rick Perry was on the board of directors of Energy Transfer and the Secretary of Energy. So I think some of the decisions that the administration has made early on, you know, represent kind of a pro-energy tilt, if you will. And I think it's important that, you know, some of these pipelines, originally it would take maybe 12 months to get some, you know, to get through the processes, and now it becomes 15 months and 18 months. And if company management teams have a clearer vision into kind of the timeline, they're, you know, you don't hold up capital and you can be better allocators of capital, which I think is important for management teams.
No, it's definitely helpful. And I'm going to throw it back to you, Ben. You know, one of the questions also that I tend to get a lot, and hopefully some of you in the audience are wondering the answer to it, with all the drilling or the additional drilling that we're seeing in the U.S. With, you know, oil and nat gas, et cetera, do we think there's going to be, does that essentially, you know, in the future, should we be worried about potential pricing, you know, pricing issues as far as pipelines go? You know, in other words, the more we drill, mm-hmm. the lower the energy prices are, and that'll manifest itself.
So I think more so it'll become a supply and demand issue when you look at the pipes. And, you know, when you look at contract renegotiations, it really depends on what basin you're in, what the possibilities are of getting the supply out of the basin, how many pipes exist, are you piping or a truck or rail or whatnot, because that's the most important part is the supply-demand dynamics behind it, because that's going to be more indicative of future pricing of contracts rather than, you know, lower for longer pricing. Because if crude is lower for longer, it's probably the result of increased production in the U.S. and drillers are continuing to generate attractive returns at lower prices, which would mean continued volume flows along the pipes.
Sure.
I would just also add that it's important, though, to recognize that the global oil market is almost 100 billion barrels per day. So a million, sorry, per day. So the U.S. is only about 10% of production. And there's a large percentage of production, about 20%, that's uneconomic, that's declining. And notwithstanding global warming and electric cars, demand is growing about 1% a year, which is about a million barrels a year. So the supply and demand fundamentals are actually pretty positive for oil. And in all likelihood, the U.S. will take market share from the rest of the world, which is good for U.S. pipeline companies and U.S. storage companies and U.S. infrastructure. And it's sort of obvious if we can drill at $40, $50, and $60 and offshore, and Canada is $70, $80, and $90, that we're setting up for a pretty good long-term situation for the U.S. Energy industry.
Sure.
I would just also add to that, you know, Schlumberger on their call last week, on their earnings call, said that last year there was 30 billion barrels of oil produced and only 5 billion of reserves that became proved. So there is this dynamic because crude is obviously a declining base. So if capital is not put into the space, you know, the U.S. shale should represent an increasing grower of the overall market share.
Okay, great. Ed, to you, you know, the whole active versus passive debate, and in my mind, I cover both actively managed and passively managed MLP products. However, in this particular space, it does appear that active managers are able to generate some alpha. Why do you think this is? I mean, are the dispersions greater in this particular sector relative to other sectors, or what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we offer both. So I think, you know, there can be advantages to disadvantages to both areas. But generally, I would consider us an active manager, and that's what we've been historically. I think you can add value just because, you know, people look at MLPs, that's a tax structure. It's not a reflection of a business model. And the business models that are approved to be under the MLP structure can vary dramatically. And particularly when you see the market really heat up, Investors really do seem to fail to recognize the different risk parameters within various business models. And when we see the commodity volatility rear its head, on the way out, investors don't really recognize that business model or even what particular commodity some of these pipeline companies are dealing with. So I do think that you should be careful when you look at a passive MLP product to make sure that that's really what you want to invest in, because in many cases that'll include coal, shipping, and what used to be E&P MLPs when they existed before they all blew up. I mean, if you want midstream pipeline investments with those characteristics, you got to be aware that if you use an ETF, in many cases you're going to see some investment drift from there.
Sure. So one of the things that we were talking about as we were coming up the stairs here is sort of the potential for corporate tax rate cuts and what are the ramifications for MLPs and in particular MLP funds that are structured as C-Corps. And I know each one of you kind of wanted to take a little shot at that. So I don't know, Jay, if you want to start on that.
Yes. So I guess the way I think about it is, first of all, there really wasn't any significant detail released, so you got to be careful about concluding. But there's been no proposals to change or try to negatively impact or go after MLPs. So that's important to note because I think MLPs were a little bit weak yesterday. I'm not sure that was exactly related to the tax disclosure. And then there's some pretty complicated things that are not necessarily, we have really no idea where they're going to come out. But first of all, there's many MLP funds that are held in corporations. A lot of Tortoise's products are closed-end funds that are corporations. Our product, which is an ETF, is a corporation. The largest ETF is also a corporation. So that's hugely positive for them because we reduce that drag. So it goes from 35% to, I would argue, more likely 20, 15 maybe an art of the deal point, and it's hard to make that work. The other dynamic that's a little bit complicated, too, is that right now MLPs have great tax characteristics. That's why we can hold them in corporations, because we get accelerated depreciation. So that's about five-year depreciation. If we went to expensing, which has been widely discussed, I'm not sure whether that'll get into the final bill, then all of a sudden we're going to be massively more depreciation, and there'll be really very little tax for most investors who hold MLPs directly or through corporations. So that's actually another upside. And it's very unclear how the administration is going to make a distinction between partnerships that are publicly traded, partnerships that have hot dog stands, partnerships that are hedge funds, partnerships that own real estate, and how those are either going to be 15% or not. So until those rules come out, I mean, it's possible. I wouldn't think it's super likely, but it's not impossible. And maybe you get taxed at 15% on your MLPs. They'll probably try to avoid that, but I think that it's going to be, like I said, they're really in for a lot of complexity. When you create this differential between personal and other rates, it just was a hornet's nest of problems. So I probably wouldn't make any decisions right now to buy or sell MLPs based on tax right now, because I think it's too far up in the air.
You guys want to add anything on that front?
No, I thought that was perfect. Yeah,
yeah, that's good.
Okay, no, that works. I'm going to pass it over to you, Ben. Any particular areas of the MLP market? I know this is kind of a generic question, mm-hmm. just because there's so many. As Ed had mentioned, MLPs are really just a structure, right? But any particular areas of the pipeline market that you're seeing great opportunities, and then maybe on the flip side, where you're staying away from?
Yeah, I would say I think two areas of opportunities that we're looking at. I think, one of the things for as MLP investors is you try to follow the rigs. You see where the rigs are going, because that's where production's going to be and that's where volumes are going to be. And we've seen a large increase in the Permian, which is in West Texas, and we've seen a doubling in the rig count last year in the Marcellus and Utica. So I think those two areas present pretty good opportunities, because you're seeing increasing capital spent by the E&P companies, which in turn results, MLPs needing new, whether it's crude gathering, gas gathering, terminals, pipelines, et cetera. I think to that extent, those present some pretty good opportunities at the moment.
Anything on where you're shying away from? Or?
I would say, we continue to look at, companies that continue to be in the high IDR splits or the high IDR splits, low coverage, high leverage. I think those are still areas that we're trying to that I think are a void for the time being.
Right, right. And I mean, I know a number of your portfolios have a little bit more of like a smaller cap bias. Is that something that you guys feel still pretty confident in?
Yeah, I think some of the smaller cap names continue to present attractive opportunities. Those are where, you know, one specific project could present a, you know, a solid returns, which in turn lead to more distribution growth or higher coverage or EBITDA growth or whatnot.
Sure, no, that's fair. Ed, I'm gonna come to you now. And you know, one of the questions I get around, you know, the downturn that we saw in 2015, you know, really was that any different than prior downturns and then the subsequent rebound? You know, did it feel a lot different to you than you've seen in prior downturns?
I guess because I look the oldest, you're going to ask me that. I think from the length of time in terms of we've seen commodity price volatility before, we've seen it, you know, that volatile, but the length of time that this lasted was historically long. So I think that was definitely the difference. The rebound looks and kind of like typical MLP rebounds, where it kind of rebounds quite dramatically. However, what we did see for the first time is we saw some of these bellwether companies really have to rebound through simplification transactions or cutting their distributions. And I think the lesson there was many times the reason for that was is that the MLP companies and their general partner made a blanket assumption that there would be access to capital, both equity and debt. And when those capital markets closed, they were companies that caught themselves, you know, in an over-leveraged position or at a distribution coverage ratio less than one. So they suffered the most. So I think right now, at least the sector seems to be focusing a little bit more on balance sheet strength and building excess distribution coverage as opposed to just continuous growth no matter what. Now, I hope that continues because we're going to hit another volatile down cycle at some point down the road. I don't know when, but when it does come, if we can kind of keep within normal leverage ratios and keep excess distribution coverage, then, you know, you're not going to be immune to price volatility, but hopefully you'll be immune to having to make those distribution cuts and things
sure.
like that.
Sort of along those lines, I mean, does Tortoise have an outlook over the next, you know, 1, 2, 3 years as far as dividend growth? I know, you know, prior to the downturn, everyone had been talking about high single-digit dividend growth. Is that a thing of the past, or, you know,
no,
what's your outlook?
I mean, it depends, but we're in general, you're looking at 5 to 7% distribution growth. But I think you got to stop, pause there. That's easy to say, and all of us are saying that. But, you know, double-digit distribution growth from Williams, which significantly cut their distribution, you know, let's pause there. And, you know, if you go from 80 cents to 20, but then you're going to grow it from 10 going on there, that's not exactly the same as someone who's kind of kept their distribution growing consistently. So I think you got to look at it as, you know, we got a number of companies that are going to grow at double digits, one, because they cut it, or two, because they have a lot of drop-down assets available to them. That's very attractive. You're going to have a whole group of people that are working on excess distribution coverage and balance sheet strength, so they're going to be zero to very little. And then you've got the other guys that are kind of the normalized growth of 5 to 7%. So just be careful when you try to lump them all together because they're all coming from different places.
Right, so it really does run the gamut. Jay, over to you. I mean, the model where MLPs went to capital markets to raise money to expand, I mean, do you think that model is broken or what, you know, what does that look like going forward?
Well, I think that it's alive and well. I mean, certainly the, you know, our models would show, or just history really, that a fair value for MLPs right now would be around 5% yield instead of 7%, and then of course every project is way more accretive if you can finance at 5% versus 7%. But what I think will happen, to the extent that capital markets remain dislocated or slightly dislocated, you'll just simply have a smaller capital budget. You'll be more focused on internal growth projects, which all have normally at least about 20% equity IRRs. And if you focus on that and do a little bit fewer acquisitions, then even if you have a GP drag, you can still do accretive growth. So, and we've already seen some attenuation, and I think we're growing more like, or many companies are growing 7, 8, 9, now they're more growing 4, 5, 6. So I think it just had a little bit slower growth, and you still, to the extent that we're dislocated from 5 and we're at 7, you have a little slower growth, you still get your 12 or 13%.
Sure.
So we think that the model's not broken. I think we think it's okay to have IDRs as well. It's okay to get rid of them too, as
sure.
It does usually get capitalized into the market in terms of multiple, but we don't see the model being broken by any means.
No, that's fair. And so Jay had mentioned GPs, and that's another question that we get often. What's the difference between a GP and an LP? So I don't know, Ben, if you can maybe just sort of briefly break that down to us
in a
somewhat concise fashion, and then maybe, you know, are you seeing any opportunities in the GPs, and how should we look at that?
Yeah, so the GP versus the LP, the GP is typically the holder and the kind of operator of the assets, and the GP would be the general partner and the owner of the incentive distribution rights, which means they get an increasing percentage of the distribution as the LP grows their distribution over time. For example, today we actually, Antero Midstream, which is an MLP, their GP is currently in the process of going public. And what you see is that, with pricing next week, and Antero Midstream is a company that is growing its distribution 28 to 30%, and the general partner is talking about growing its distribution 100% next year. So what you see from as a general partner versus the LP is a exponential growth rate compared to the limited partner.
You know, that's fair. And just to kind of wrap it up, my last prepared remark, and Ben, we already hit this, but Ed and Jay, where are you seeing the greatest opportunities in the market right now from your standpoint?
Well, we tend to focus more on the large cap MLPs just because we're targeting retail investors and more conservative investors. So, and our models for the larger cap companies show that the dislocation has been dramatically attenuated. So, about a year ago when we were at this conference, there was companies that were like WPZ was like a 12 or something, and it had like 50% upside. And now if you look at our models, most companies have 5 or 10% upside or downside. The companies that everybody likes to recommend that everybody was buying during the downturn are a little bit overvalued in our models, so like an MMP, EPD, just slightly overvalued, but by no means crazy, and that just gets back to maybe you just value their fact they don't have IDRs and have higher credit ratings and more liquid, so maybe just our premiums and discounts are a little bit off. But so we don't see it as a necessarily stock pickers market as much as asset class market. We do believe that the sector could easily do 20% a year for the next 3 years as we tighten into this kind of closer to 5% yield. And particularly with utilities at 3, REITs at 4, high yield at 5, we just don't see that it's likely that MLPs stay at 7 over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I think we're coming out of Q4, and good chunk of Q1 was really a risk on, where you saw a lot of the smaller, higher yielding MLPs recover quite well. So I do think it's a little bit time for the larger integrated pipeline companies to play catch up a little bit. We tend to be more demand pull driven, so pipelines that are constructed for the end user to take a commodity or refined product to an end place. We tend to stay farther away from the wellhead, although selectively there is some more supply push pipelines, I think, that'll do better. And you mentioned it, Ben, the Permian Basin and the Marcellus are still attractive areas where we either need pipeline capacity currently, or just based on rig counts are probably going to need more pipeline capacity in the next year or two. So there's selective opportunities close to the wellhead, and I still think the long-haul pipelines are still a great long-term opportunity for reasonable returns with the lowest risk profile.
Great. So we have about 6 minutes left. Let's open it up to all of you. Questions, please. In the front row here.
Okay. On pipeline companies, MLPs, I've been told over that their earnings are not so dependent on the price of oil because they have very long-term contracts. My question is, how long are these contracts usually, 10 years? And what happens when the contracts are over? Will they get a much lower rate for using the pipeline? Jordan, what is the variation in their earnings based on the oil market?
So you want to break them up. So first of all, you don't want to apply this rule to there's different types of pipelines. So first of all, natural gas, they're typically, if they're long-haul natural gas pipelines, you're contracting for capacity. If you're shorter, closer to the wellhead natural gas pipeline, you're gathering and processing. Those are either going to be fee-based or keep whole or percentage of proceeds contracts. Those last two do have commodity exposure to them. Crude oil pipelines, if you're closer to the wellhead where you're gathering that you do typically have 3 to 5 year contracts with minimums there to help you, so that if you do see production levels go down, they'll start to hit the minimums. But your inherent commodity exposure in those is really at your recontracting risk, because to your point, if drilling starts to slow down, you are going to face that reality at some point when your contract comes up for renewal. The good thing is the companies can see that and manage to it as best they can. But you can't contract away commodity exposure when you're that close to the wellhead. Outside of that, you have longer haul pipelines, common carriers, where they're really more about the use of our demand for energy, because they can, if they're a key part of our transportation area, taking it to major hubs and storage facilities, that the contracting is less apparent there, but they are volume driven. So you'd probably see more risk there if our demand for that commodity went down. How'd I do? Did I miss anything?
Right. Okay. Is there a wall when this, when a lot of these contracts come up on those that are close to the drill head? I mean, is it like 2018, 2019, where a bunch of these contracts?
Well, it just depends on when they entered into it and the timing. I mean, Plains will try to spread that out and diversify it as much as they can. But if you're really looking for, if there's a concentration in a particular basin, so if it's either a smaller MLP where most of their assets are in that basin, that's going to give you a good idea of what kind of risk they're facing.
Any other questions? Yes.
Will the lowering of the corporate tax rate, do you think that will affect MLPs? Sort of taxes?
Well, so I was trying to address that question, but it's sort of, that was, my answer is a little bit complicated. So the bottom line is no, it won't affect them. You could argue theoretically that, well, since, first of all, I don't think corporate is going to 15, let's say it's 20. Well, since the corporate's only 20, then MLPs are less attractive. But I never really thought that MLPs' fundamental attractiveness was the tax structure anyway. They're super long-lived assets that get accelerated depreciation and, as I mentioned, might be expensing, so go to 5 years to one. And so, therefore, you have tax-sheltered cash flow. And you get that tax-sheltered cash flow whether you're an individual or a corporation. That's why we run funds where we get that and file that tax return. So it's sort of a graphic demonstration that the fundamental tax benefit is not come from being a partnership versus a corporation. It comes from being a growing entity that gets accelerated depreciation. That, I don't see any scenarios where that goes away. I used to be a CPA, but so not that I'm an expert in it now, but I understand it at least. And I don't see any situation where depreciation is going away. If they're talking about expensing, and they're not going to get rid of it at maker's depreciation. So therefore, all the advantages remain. And last thing I'd say is don't forget that MLPs are structured to distribute their free cash. So KMI, they were actually pressing when they were an MLP, they would distribute as much as anybody. Then they become a corporation, and all of a sudden they decide they don't want to distribute very much of their cash flow. So just beware that if you're investing in corporations for yield, they may decide tomorrow to not distribute their free cash flow. In the partnership agreement, it says you have to distribute your free cash flow. So that's a huge advantage. It has nothing to do with tax. It has everything to do with the partnership agreement.
And you want to take that maybe one step further and talk about funds that are maybe structured as C-Corps and how they're likely to get a benefit?
Yeah, so if it wasn't clear before, so we accrue for taxes. We're an ETF, but we're a corporation. So that's AMZA. AMLP does the same. So when we actually underperform the index, but we're accruing the taxes, and then when you get that tax bet, when you get your distributions, you don't have to pay tax. But so if the tax rate goes from 35 to 15 or 20, then we have to accrue at a much lower rate.
Yeah,
so that's a benefit.
To give you an example, so TYG is the oldest closed-end fund out there, so we've been around since 2004. I think roughly $11 of our NAV is deferred tax liability. So we own those assets, but we have to say, what would my taxes be if I had to sell the whole portfolio tomorrow? So we have, I think it's $41 in assets, and our NAV is $31 roughly, or $42 in assets. Our NAV is $31. So if that tax rate dropped, we're accruing it slightly north of 35%, and it went to 20, you would see immediately, you know, a dollar or two come up in our NAV just as a result of the tax liability that we'd have to reserve for. So that's the positive, if I have that right, from the closed-end funds, is that we could get a nice bump from that potentially if that happens. But again, I'm in Jay's camp. It's too early to try. Try to start playing arbitrage or something on that. I think we got a long way to go before we know more.
All right, great. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the day.